The Senate State and Local Government Committee will come to order. It's Monday, February 25th, 2013. And the first bill on the agenda is Senate File 359. And I'm going to turn the gavel over to Senator Hall.
Okay, Senator Pappas, Senate File 359.
Thank you. Present. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee, for being here today. What Senate File 359 does is it follows up from previous legislation that we've had the past two years, where we declared April to be Genocide Awareness and Prevention Month by resolution. And we've had such good success with that now we actually want to put it in the statute. So it would designate April as Genocide Awareness and Prevention Month beginning in 2013, and then it would be ongoing. And the reason for this, and I'll introduce my witnesses in a minute, is that it really, the more we can educate ourselves and the public about the pretty horrible history we have worldwide of genocides, the more I think we can prevent future genocides and mass atrocities. It gives us an opportunity to implement effective prevention measures, to educate the public on protecting individual rights, and also promoting a culture of lawfulness that will help prevent future genocides. Obviously, you know, the one we think of the most, probably I think of the most anyway because of my Jewish background, is the Holocaust. But there are actually other genocides ongoing. The Congo is probably an example as we sit here. And so it is something that's still both history and both contemporary. And I think that it behooves us all to kind of pay attention to these issues. I'd like to turn it out now over to Professor Ellen Kennedy, who's the director of the nonprofit World Without Genocide, and she has her statement, and then she'll introduce the other witnesses.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to talk about Senate File Number 359. My name is Ellen Kennedy, director of World Without Genocide. We will present some opening remarks, and then we will hear from three survivors, two of whom are here today, and one whose testimony I will then read. A little bit of background information. The word genocide did not exist before the Holocaust. A young Polish Jew named Raphael Lemkin, a lawyer and jurist, came to the United States fleeing from the Nazis. He tried desperately to bring his family here, but 49 members of his extended family perished in the gas chambers at Auschwitz. He felt that there had to be a name to describe the killing of a people. Notice that I said of a people, not of people, for which we have terms such as homicide or fratricide. He wanted to define the killing of people defined by who they are. And he coined the term genocide. Geno, meaning group or tribe or people from the Greek, and side, the Latin prefix meaning killing. And then once he had the law, once he had the word, he felt that there had to be a law to prevent the crime. And he wrote the Genocide Convention, which was passed by the United Nations in 1948. This convention defines genocide as the attempt to exterminate, in whole or in part, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. In order for a United Nations convention to become part of the law of our land, it must be ratified by 67 members of the United States Senate. Senator William Proxmire, from our great neighboring state of Wisconsin, took on the task of trying to get that convention ratified. He thought it would certainly be very easy. Senator Proxmire gave 3,211 speeches on the floor of the Senate, a speech a day for 19 years, each one of them unique, before that bill was finally ratified 40 years later in the United States, 40 years after it had passed in the United Nations. It became known on the Hill as Proxmire's Convention. 2 years ago, World Without Genocide, some of whose student representatives are here today, hand-delivered more than 800 letters to Minnesota's senators and representatives from nearly every district throughout our state, urging support for a bill that would designate April as Genocide Awareness and Prevention Month. A dozen organizations representing faith, business, educational, and civic groups from throughout the state joined with us. And a resolution was unanimously passed in the House and the Senate that declared April 2011 to have that designation. In April 2012, we received a certificate of recognition from Governor Dayton, acknowledging our efforts to educate the public about genocide and to commemorate the victims of genocide throughout the world. We hope today to make this recognition permanent through the passage of this bill. This is our Proxmire moment for the state of Minnesota. If we don't do this now, people will look back and wonder, why didn't we do it then? After the Holocaust, the world said never again. Never again would innocent people be exterminated based solely on who they are. But these words have come to mean over and over again. Genocide happened after the Holocaust in Cambodia in the 1970s, killing one out of every four people in that country. And one of our speakers this afternoon is a survivor of that conflict. In 1994, in the genocide in Rwanda, 800,000 people were killed in 100 days. In Bosnia, in the 1990s, 200,000 people perished. A genocide back in Europe, half a century after the Holocaust. In 2003, genocide broke out in the Darfur region of Sudan, a genocide that continues today. In 2008, the Genocide Prevention Task Force was convened by the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum and other agencies. It was chaired by former Secretary of State and former UN Ambassador Madeleine Albright and by William Cohn, former Secretary of Defense. Their report outlines critical steps to take to prevent genocide. And the first and most important step that Senator Pappas referred to is education. Today's proposed bill, number 359, is modeled on similar legislation passed by California in 2010 and Texas in 2011, illustrating that states recognize the importance of holding events to honor survivors, inform about genocides past and present, and to engage ordinary citizens in promoting peace and justice. Minnesota has a history of welcoming refugees from the world's worst conflicts. People who have fled from the horrors in Cambodia, Bosnia, Rwanda, Darfur, Congo, Somalia, Burma, and elsewhere. We have chosen April for this important designation, like other states, because it is the month in which the anniversaries of many of these tragedies have occurred. Minnesota has a history of standing up against genocide as a state. In 2007, Governor Pawlenty signed into law a bill that divested our state public pension fund from companies that were directly or indirectly funding the genocide in Darfur. Minnesotans did not want their tax dollars complicit in that genocide. To date, 29 states in the nation have divested, and Minnesota was one of the earliest to do so. Seven cities then followed the state's lead, more cities than in any other state. All of you undoubtedly have refugees in your districts, people whose stories we don't truly know or understand. This bill honors them. Your folders have information about the bill, our programs, and information that we think will help to share this perspective. Many students participate in our work. They are here representing high schools, colleges, law schools. They have committed to a future of advocacy for human rights. And it is the opportunity for the Senate today to support their efforts as well. The most important words are those of the survivors. And it is my great honor first to introduce to you Fred Amram on my far right, emeritus professor at the University of Minnesota and a Holocaust survivor.
Thank you. Mr. Amram, welcome. If you could please say your name and then continue with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Fred Amram, A-M-R-A-M. On January 30th, 1933, Hitler became Chancellor of Germany. 2 months later, in March of 1933, Dachau opened its gates as the first concentration camp. In April, Hitler ordered a boycott of all Jewish-owned stores. 8.5 months later, a Jewish boy was born in a Catholic infant's home. I was that boy. Why would a Jewish boy be born in a Catholic infant's home? Because already in September, 8.5 months after Hitler became chancellor, health care was denied to Jews. And one particular convent in our city, Hanover, Germany, welcomed Jews to their agency. Things got worse. In April 1935, 15 months after Hitler became chancellor, the Nuremberg Laws were passed, which denied citizenship to all Jews and forbade all Jews from working in the civil service. Where was everybody? Where was the world? Who was listening? It seemed as though no one was. 2 years after that, 1937, my mother took me to the park at our corner, Goetheplatz. I was a young boy at that time. As we came into the park, we saw that one bench said Nur für Juden, only for Jews. At the time, as a boy, I thought that was pretty cool. A bench just for me. I wondered at the time if Hitler was making up for all those bad things he had done. But the next week when we went, all the other benches said Nur für Arier, only for Aryans. My bench was special in that way, a negative way. And those were the good days when Jews were allowed to use parks. Not long after that, the Gestapo, guns drawn, invaded our home. They took my father's business, emptied it out, lock, stock, and barrel. In 1938, 5 years after Hitler became chancellor, the German army walked into Austria, the Anschluss. Now the whole world was involved. But where was everybody? It seemed that the world didn't care. It seemed that no one was paying attention. And then on November 8, 1938, was the famous Kristallnacht, Crystal Night, the night of broken glass, when all the synagogues in Germany and now Austria were burned. Shortly after that, my father was taken into slave labor. Again, I ask, where was everybody? Was anyone paying attention? Did anyone care? Was there any awareness? In this country in 1938, Benny Goodman was playing at Carnegie Hall. Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs was released. That seemed to take more attention than what was going on in a genocide. If the world had interceded, I would not have become a refugee in a new land with a new language. I have a friend from Golden Valley who I helped to author a book about her experiences in the Holocaust. And one of the stories tells about her experience in Auschwitz in 1944, now 11 years after Hitler became chancellor. She described being starved and tortured, and she tells how the inmates at Auschwitz, the prisoners, looked into the sky, wondering if planes would come over. Where is everybody, they asked. Does anyone know? Do they care? Other than my wife and children, I have no relatives. My cousins and my uncles and my aunts have all been left in Germany, in the gas chambers and the crematoria and the slave labor camps and the ghettos. My relatives are the 6 million. One last story, an experience I had right here on the state capitol steps. I came here for a rally about genocide, and there were a series of speakers from a variety of countries, and the last of them was Alice Musabende from Rwanda. Alice began by telling very quietly how when she was 14, she came back after being sent on an errand, and she found her grandparents slaughtered, her parents dead, her sister, age 12, dead, her brothers, 9 and 2, dead. And she became ever more dramatic, and she finally ended by saying, "Never again." Clenching her fist, she said, "Never again." And at first I became angry because I thought that was my slogan. That was the slogan of Holocaust survivors. Jews say, "Never again." And here was Alice Musabende from Rwanda saying never again. And then I started to cry because I realized that Alice is, in fact, my sister. We're both child survivors. Different genocides at different times. But we share never again. At no expense, every Minnesota senator can say, "I care," can say, "I want to remember the Holocaust and every other genocide," can say, "I want to do my bit to help prevent future genocides." Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, today I would like to create a miracle, the miracle of never again.
Thank you, Mr. Amram.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have chosen April for this important designation, like the other states have done, because it is the month in which the anniversaries of 6 of these tragedies are officially memorialized. April 3rd, the Darfur genocide. April 5th, the anniversary of the siege of Sarajevo, Bosnia. April 7th, Rwandan Genocide Remembrance Day. April 8th, Holocaust Remembrance Day. April 17th, anniversary of the Cambodian Genocide. April 24th, Armenian Genocide Remembrance Day. I would like now to introduce Bunkin Chun. He is a teacher and he is a survivor of the Cambodian Genocide.
Thank you, Mr. Chun, if you would identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Bunkin Chun, C-H-U-N. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, member of committee. Again, my name is Bunkin Chun. I'm a math teacher at Roosevelt High School, Minneapolis School District. I'm one of the genocide survivors from Cambodia. I was born in Pusat province in northwestern of Cambodia. I was the youngest of five children. My father died when my mother was pregnant with me. Nobody in my family had gone to school, gone to college. So it was important for me to go. My siblings provided whatever financial assistance they could muster to help pay for my education. I was their last hope of becoming a doctor. I then went to study medicine in Phnom Penh. Although the Vietnam War carried to the east, life, for the most part, wasn't that bad. Like many other students, I had a part-time job as a cyclo driver, pedicab driver in the city, working nights and weekends. Phnom Penh at that time had invigorating charms to it. In a time where war surrounded Cambodia, it was easy to appreciate the peacefulness of the city. Shortly after I started school, I heard horrific stories of thousands of innocent Cambodians being killed in the countryside. Spillover from the Vietnam War, inevitable. Cambodia felt pressured by both sides of the war, the United States and North Vietnam, but refused to get involved. Then, in 1970, the war began. The war was between the Khmer Republics and Viet Cong aggressors. Later, the war shifted to fight against the Khmer Rouge as they gained their strength. Within the next 2 or 3 years, Phnom Penh population sharply increased from 500,000 to 2 million. The city was the only place the people could flee to escape the war. Many lost farming land and many lost loved ones. They came to Phnom Penh with anything they could carry with them. Most people had to start over and try to raise their family in an already crowded city. After the war had ended, the Khmer Rouge took over on April 17, 1975. After taking the city, the Phnom Penh, the Khmer Rouge forced the evacuation of 2 million residents to the countryside on foot in a few days. Because it was so crowded, it took people maybe weeks to get out of the city. Just imagine with me. Now, we all are walking. Now you are walking in hot sun with your sandals. After walking a long period of time, your sandal breaks. you start walking barefoot, your feet become blistered. The road burns your soul as you continue walking. You also carry a heavy load, and it gets heavier and heavier. April is the driest and hottest month of the year, and drinking water is limited. Some women are carrying babies in their arms. Children are crying as they trudge along with their parents, and even they are carrying something. On the side of the road, the Khmer Rouge punished those who slowed down. I could hear a child asking his parents, "When do we go back home, Papa?" And I could see his parents' faces, speechless, not knowing when they were going to stop. The healthy became weaker and weaker. The sick people could not endure the torturous walk any longer, and many collapsed and died along the road. I witnessed a man holding his mother's dying body in his arm. His pregnant wife and young child stood nearby, sobbing. He cried for help, but there was nothing that could have been done. That was only one of many tragedies that occurred during this march of death. After 3 weeks of this, we reached what Khmer Rouge told us was our destination. There, we were told to start a new life. First, they dehumanized us. Our hard labor seemed never end. Our rations were almost nothing. We ate boiled bamboo shoot with green leaves and sometimes anything we could find. We ate in the morning and ate at night to conserve our rations. If we could, we'd make our food with a little bit of rice. It was tough work, and there was so little food to eat. Some people fell down and died along the road. Sometimes the Khmer Rouge had no ration for us at all, and we were stuck finding food on our own. People disappeared every night. One day, I was granted permission to go to another village about 30 kilometers away by bike. But something strange happened when I was away. Former government workers, military personnel, teachers, and civil servants had a chance to go back to Phnom Penh to rebuild the country's infrastructure. They were given an opportunity to start their life again. They were told they didn't have to work in the field. I was very upset. If I would have been there, I might have volunteered to go with them too. They were all lied to. Instead, the Khmer Rouge put these people on a truck and murdered them in a forest one truck at a time. News spread quickly of this deceptive promise. This regime killed almost 2 million innocent people, including children. I finally escaped to Cambodian-Thai border in 1979. I arrived in the U.S. on August 23, 1981. When I went back to Cambodia in 1993, my sister-in-law showed me our family picture taken in 1972. This is the picture that I had. In that picture, there was my three brothers, my only sister, my mother, and me. All of them in the picture but me were killed by the Khmer Rouge. Man-made genocide like this is prone to happen again. Please help us to prevent it from happening again. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Chun. Senator Pappas? Senator Pappas, yes. Do you want to do questions now from any members?
Sure.
Okay, any members have questions for any of the those that gave testimony? Okay, hearing none. Do we have more testifiers, or would you like to proceed?
I think we're done with our testifiers.
That's fine. Thank you.
Okay. I had here a Bahanyan.
Yes. Is there time to read her statement?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. The statement is from Zara Bishanyan. To whom it may concern, my grandparents survived the Armenian genocide perpetrated by the Turks of the Ottoman Empire during the years of 1915 to 1923. They survived by fleeing the city of Kars, now in modern Turkey, and relocating to the city of Gumri, now in the Republic of Armenia. My great-grandfather had arranged to move his family to safety and accompanied them on their journey. He then returned to his ancestral home in Kars to retrieve the last of their belongings. On his way back to his family and to safety, he was stopped by Turkish gendarmes, robbed and brutally beaten nearly to death. Eventually, he returned to his family and was miraculously nursed back to health. This is just one of the heart-wrenching stories I grew up listening to, as told by my grandmother. As sad as this story is, 1.5 million Armenians did not survive to tell theirs. My grandmother would have never imagined that I would recall these stories here in Minnesota, where I immigrated 18 years ago from Armenia and now work as a Spanish teacher in Lanesboro, Minnesota. It is also hard to imagine that a conflict that happened so long ago and so far away still affects Minnesotans today. I think about my grandmother's stories every day and the genocide that nearly eliminated my people. I think I can speak for the Armenians when I say that we would like the return of our lost family, our lost homeland, and our lost culture. But mostly we want recognition and remembrance of an event that lives with us to this day. Recognition because the event is a defining event of our existence, and remembrance because the last victim of genocide is truth. Please adopt a resolution to proclaim April as Genocide Awareness and Prevention Month. That was from Zara Bishanyan. Senator Proxmire said that the most lethal pair of foes to human rights are ignorance and indifference. This proposed legislation encourages education. The moral arc of the universe is long, but it bends toward justice, said Martin Luther King Jr. And today we are here to try to help bend that arc. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Kennedy.
Of the committee.
Is there a Mr. Riggs here then? Mrs. Riggs? Ms. Riggs? If you'd come up and take one of the chairs here then. Ms. Riggs, if you would state your name and then continue with your testimony, please.
My name is Ezra Riggs, and I'm here on behalf of the Turkish American Association of Minnesota. And we would like to commend Senator Pappas and all the other co-authors of this bill. And we wanted to come out here and state our strong support for the bill and the need for it. And that being said, we also would like to propose an amendment to the language, in addition to the language of it, to clearly define what actually constitutes genocide. And basically, while we agree with the bill's already prospective nature regarding possible genocides in the future and its definition of the crime based on the strict definition in the 1948 UN Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide, we submit that the bill emphasizes that whether a case constitutes genocide is a judicial determination to be made after the application of due process. Accordingly, after the first sentence, we respectfully recommend that the following sentence be inserted. Genocide is a crime defined by law. As such, cases that constitute genocide for the purpose of this bill shall be those that a court or tribunal of competent jurisdiction applying rigorous standards of due process has determined the crime as defined by the United Nations of Convention on Prevention and Punishment of Genocide has been committed. Now, the reason behind our recommendation for this bill, as you just heard from Dr. Kennedy's testimony too, she had read a letter from a descendant of a sufferer of the Armenian, what we call is revolt and or tragedy, and what some Armenian descendants call or claim to be genocide. And they had taken this course to the court, to the International Court of Justice, and it has been determined that it cannot be said to be genocide. So as of today, there's no court decision on this case saying that this is a genocide committed by such and such group or such and such people or such and such state. As a result, my concern as a Minnesotan American and as a parent of a small child in the school district is that my child will go into the school district and come April during the efforts to educate our young kids on genocide and crimes against humanity and all, she'll be singled out as a descendant of a genocidal nation, basically, which has never been by a court affirmed to be so. Now, in terms of the events that transpired during that time, I don't know how much information you have. It is very much not part of the U.S. history, so not many people have any direct or indirect knowledge of it. The time frame, 1999 and 1923, is right at the end of the First World War, when modern Turkey today, what we have as our country, was still being divided on maps by the allied nations who won the war. And the Ottoman Empire had conceded to give the country away, almost, but some members of the army actually defected, went to Anatolia, and started an independence war. So you're talking about an Ottoman Empire crumpled, covered and surrounded, and many territories lost. Actual war going on so many fronts, including Russia. And then you're talking about a starved nation fighting for its independence, trying to put out revolts and stop invasions at the same time. And during which time, we do not disagree that many Armenians have lost their life alongside many Turks, Kurds, Jewish, and other minorities of the modern Turkey today.
Mr. Chairman, I really appreciate the committee taking all this
Senator
time.
Pappas.
And what I would like to suggest is that I work with Madam President here, and we look to see if there's something in the language that we can clarify, since we do have to go to the Rules Committee. But I realize we're not a foreign policy committee, and that is probably important that we move on.
Okay.
Unless there are any questions that anyone has.
Any questions from the members?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 359 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Rules Committee.
Okay. Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 359 be passed and moved to the Rules Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed nay. It does pass.
Thank you.
Members, let's have Senate File 570 come forward, and I just really appreciate everyone's kind of understanding and thoughtful listening. I admit I didn't realize it was going to take quite a while, but it's hard to, when people want to tell their story, you know, and it's such an important and such a tragic story. It's hard to get them to move along. I have my pen. Here, I must lift it up there. Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Madam Chair, I have an amendment to put the bill in the form that I need to put it in. Do you want to do that first, or do you want me to explain it first?
Let's pass out the A13 amendment. It's in the packet. Okay, we have it. I'm just looking for it. Okay, would someone like to move this for Senator Tomassoni?
Move the amendment.
Senator Johnson moves the A13 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Tomassoni.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. The Senate File 570 is a bill that requires that each new state funded building and major renovations to existing buildings shall dedicate 5% of the funding provided by state bonding to be used for renewable solar energy on the building. There's a maximum solar size, however, of 40 kilowatts per building. And to give you just a comparison, a home would generally have about a size of about 4 kilowatts. So on a large project, 40 kilowatts would be the maximum. There's a requirement for the solar systems to be made in Minnesota and benefits of our local economy, Minnesota workers. And this language, for the most part, is already in law from last session. We are just strengthening the May part to the shell, and we're, and if possible, I think it has to go to the bonding committee after that.
We have a request from the Environment and Energy Committee.
Okay, all right, and so that's it in a nutshell, Madam Chair, and I have some people with me from the solar industry and from the Sheet Metal Workers Union and from the department also, who would like to testify. And that's about the gist of the bill, I think. Well, who would
okay.
like to go first?
Who would like to start? Mr. Hinkle?
Yes, please. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Hinkle, H-I-N-K-L-E, and I'm the policy director for the Minnesota Solar Energy Industry Association. Our members include original equipment manufacturers, supply chain manufacturers of components and materials, distributors, installers, contractors, trainers. We represent essentially the entire solar value chain in Minnesota. MNSEA strongly supports this bill, Senate File 570. It's much more than bonding or bonding and energy. It's a jobs bill, helping grow not only original equipment manufacturers in the manufacture of solar electric modules, but solar thermal and a vast network of Minnesota manufacturing suppliers. It's good family-sustaining jobs all over the state. These are bonding dollars well spent. These are bonding dollars well used. Nothing creates jobs per $1 million spent better than solar, according to the Political Economy Research Institute in Amherst, Massachusetts. And according to the National Renewable Energy Lab's economic modeling, every dollar spent on solar creates over 7 more throughout Minnesota's economy. Please support this bill. It's a Minnesota jobs engine. This bill helps create a demand signal that will help make Minnesota a target for significant solar development.
Any questions for Mr. Hinkle?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator
Mr.
Anderson.
Hinkle, I see by this Silicon Energy that they're located in Mountain Iron, Minnesota. How many employees does Mountain Iron or the Silicon Energy Company have there in Mountain Iron?
Mr. Anderson, we do have the president of Silicon Energy testifying next. Would you like to
I just thought he
question.
Might have an answer.
Okay, well, Mr. Hinkle might, because you're talking about number of employees. Mr. Hinkle.
It's my understanding that they have approximately 15 employees at this point.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson? Okay. Senator Anderson, sorry. Any other questions for Mr. Hinkle? All right, Mr. Shaver.
He's not here.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Pardon me. My name is Joel Cannon. I'm CEO of 10K Solar.
Would you like to go next?
Yes.
Okay,
we
have, Mr. Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. In the interest of brevity, Silicon Energy and 10K Solar are speaking through me. I'm the.
Okay.
We're both manufacturers in the state. on behalf of all the manufacturers in the state, we'd like to thank you all for your support of this policy last year, and we appreciate the efforts of Senator Tomassoni to strengthen the measure this year. This is really, from our way of thinking, a very good intersection of public policy and energy policy. When we put solar on a public building, the job creation benefits everyone in the state, the economic development of those jobs created benefit everyone in the state, and the energy savings benefit the taxpayers. We are able now to produce energy at a very competitive price and to reduce the operating cost for state buildings over the long term by putting solar on the buildings. What's more is the cost of deploying solar is includes a lot of soft costs which can be eliminated when you're doing other work on a building. So there's engineering studies, there's architecture work to be done. When you're doing a solar installation from scratch, all of those costs get applied to the solar installation. But this bill ties the solar installation to work which is being done to either build or expand buildings. And so we're able to reduce the cost of solar further by just spreading the engineering costs and architecture costs over the entire project. In short, we employ several dozen people in Bloomington, Minnesota, through indirect employment, through installers. Many dozens of other jobs are created. We thank you for considering this and ask for your support.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Cannon? Okay. Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Mr. Cannon, do you have a brochure of any sorts? Of what's your, I don't know if I've got it.
It's in your packet, the 10K solar, and then also one from Silicon
Energy.
Yes,
I do have it now. Yeah. Thanks. Thank you. Appreciate that. Mr. Cannon? How many people do you have working for you at your 10K?
We have about 5 and a half dozen. And that includes manufacturing, engineering, sales, and admin.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Cannon, how much of your money comes from state government or federal government for doing solar energy?
Mr. Cannon?
Madam Chair, Senator, none.
Okay, thank you.
And then so we're not having Mr. Shaver. Are we having Mr. Paris?
Okay. That's correct. Madam Chair, committee, my name is Pete Paris. I'm with the Sheet Metal Workers Union. We are part of a broad coalition of the Energy Jobs Association, which includes labor unions, contractors, the ESCOs, and our whole purpose is to create jobs and make our state more energy efficient through the governor's executive order is one of the ways. So with this bill, we do support it, along with the Energy Jobs Association and myself. We hope for passage, and thank you for any questions.
Okay, any questions from members of the committee? Anybody else would like to testify? All right, seeing done. Does someone want to make a motion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Hall.
Can I ask, do we get fiscal notes on these?
We're not a fiscal committee, so it's more a policy decision for us about, I guess, changing the, on 2.13, the may to shall. That seems to be,
okay.
Is there anything else, Council, that our committee would have jurisdiction over?
There's some tweaks on a definition, I think, Madam Chair.
Go ahead. Ms. James.
Madam Chair and members, also on lines 2.25 through 2.29, it gives the commissioner the requirement to establish criteria for awarding solar energy systems. These would be state contracts, and so procurement is part of our area as well. Mm-hmm.
So they have to include the system's estimated life cycle costs, and so there's some criteria in here that they should look at.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I'm troubled with the fact that we're going to mandate this to the commissioner to have to force this in, and I would like to have a roll call.
Okay, roll call has been requested. Any other? Yes, Senator Eaton. Oh, Senator Eaton. Okay, any other questions? All right, then. Senator Eaton moves that Senate File 570 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate Environment and Energy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Pappas?
Yes.
Eaton?
Yes.
Hall?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Dahl?
Yes.
Hayden?
Yes.
Housley?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Peterson? Scalzi?
Yes.
Thompson?
No.
Torres Ray?
Yes.
Wicklund?
Yes.
There being 8 in favor and 4 opposed, the motion does pass.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you very much, Senator Tomassoni. The next bill on the agenda is Senate File 344, Senator Benson, Capitol Complex Area Security. And no amendment. Do you have no amendment? No. Okay. All right. Senator Benson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I have Senate File 344. This has been quite a long process in coming, and I'm joined by some very prestigious and experienced testifiers. So I will move through the bill quickly, and then we'll get to their testimony. Find my notes. Public safety is a constitutional responsibility. And last year, the House and Senate and the governor signed an Advisory Committee on Capital Area Security. We've been through a number of capital security groups. That group's first responsibility was to review the safety of the public, to create an open and welcoming environment here at the Capitol Complex, and to have a functional complex for the visitors who join us each day. Now, you should have in your packets a map of the Capitol Security Complex, or the Capitol Complex, I'm sorry, for which the security bill applies. It goes all the way from the History Center to the parking lots north of the Capitol, all of those buildings exclusive of the Armory. So it is quite
I'm sorry, Senator Benson, our committee was not given that
wasn't
map.
Wasn't given those packets?
You can describe it again. Where does it go to?
Reaches all the way from the Minnesota History Center near the Capitol and north of the Capitol to Lot Q. It reaches all the way over to the Stassen Revenue Building and then to one parking lot, the A parking lot, that is just north of the Sears customer parking lot. Okay. This area is visited by school groups at the Capitol, ambassadors to the Department of Agriculture, and, of course, our staff who's here for long hours and late nights. The state employees who serve us so well also expect to be safe when they come to work, and that is why this bill is being brought forward. In 2009, the Office of the Legislative Auditor noted that there had been 5 prior audits. And then when Gabby Giffords was shot, the governor and then Republican leadership asked that a commission be formed to take another look at Capitol security. There had been many starts and stops. There had even been a National Guard report outlining critical incidents. But we didn't have someone held accountable, and we didn't have adequate resources. So in 2012, the advisory committee made of legislators, members of the judiciary, and executives brought in experts. We talked about how to move Capitol security forward and not waste any more time in fixing this problem. This is timely because light rail will increase foot traffic, and our Capitol is undergoing a massive once-in-a-lifetime, well, actually once-in-150-years renovation. They're going to need input, and we're going to need to think about how we do things differently. Currently, our Capitol security systems are siloed. Each building is responsible for its own security and its own budget. The resources are not flexible and are not efficiently coordinated, though our staff does very well with what they're given. So in this bill, we establish a manager at the Department of Public Safety who will take a comprehensive view of our Capitol security needs. They will make sure that each facility's needs are met, resources are allocated and moved as needed, and will report to the legislature so that we can make decisions about resources that remain in place or are further funded. We do not have a fiscal note at this time. I asked for it several weeks ago, and it is on its way.
And we'll hear, Senator Benson, that's fine, because you'll go to finance from here. So
I just want committee members to be aware that it has been asked for, and I would like to give them more information. I just don't have it at this time. As you consider this bill, I'd like you to remember that security is about planning and preparation, including proper training. It is about situational awareness, adequate resources, and appropriate response. Lights and sirens are the last thing we want to see should an incident ever happen at this Capitol. And we believe by taking these steps now, we will improve safety for everyone who visits us and everyone who works here. And then if I could ask my testifiers, Mr. Danansky and Major Meyerson, I'll have Mr. Danansky go first.
Mr. Danansky,
Madam
welcome.
Chair, thank you. Madam Chair, members, my name is Mark Danansky. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Public Safety. Prior to my appointment to this position, I served in the Minnesota State Patrol the last 6 years as the chief of that organization. And so I've had a number of years in looking at the situation here on the Capitol Complex and dealing with the security issues associated with it. As the Senator mentioned, over the years, and I can't remember if it's gone back since 2001, I think there's been seven different studies and processes looking at security on the complex, including the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the National Guard, Secret Service, and then recently the Legislative Auditor's Report that came forward. As she also mentioned, that there were similar findings in most of those reports. And unfortunately, over time, it seemed that a lot of things didn't get accomplished that were pointed out in those reports. We were very pleased when the Committee on Capitol Security started doing its work. And I must say, I sat in on all the meetings, and the focus of most of those meetings was not on resources, but rather on, as Senator Benson pointed out, how do we create a culture and an environment on the Capitol complex where people come here and feel very safe, as though they were walking someplace around their house and not being concerned for their safety. And as the Senator also pointed out, it's a large area. I think when we talk about the Capitol complex, people tend to think about this structure, when in fact it encompasses 140 acres and I believe 17 different buildings. So it's large, and there are a lot of things that are happening out here. As I mentioned, the committee spent a lot of time talking about the culture of safety, not necessarily about resources, and how do we move forward in that. And I would point out two of the areas specifically were talking about putting the final authority with the Commissioner of Public Safety so that there is somebody that is held accountable for the plans and processes and for making sure that things are done in an efficient and effective manner on the complex. In addition to that, as the Senator pointed out, an emergency manager within the Department of Public Safety here at the Capitol Complex that goes about and takes all of the plans and policies and procedures that are out there, brings them all together so that we have a unified process. Some of you may be unaware that if there's a bomb threat in the transportation building, the plan and procedure for responding to that bomb threat could be significantly different than the one in the Department of Agriculture. And so there's no consistency across the system simply because of the way that it's kind of diverged and it's moved in its own direction. And Major Meyerson will talk about the contract process that's also built into this that has caused us some problems. So there was a lot of discussion outside the scope of merely resources. And I would echo one last thing that the Senator brought up, and that is that many times as we start to talk about security, we tend to think in terms of ourselves and whether we feel safe or not. And we're very grateful. The Department of Public Safety is very grateful that the committees and the legislators are talking about this out in the open. And as Senator Benson said, it's not only for the legislators and the judges and the executive branch, but probably more importantly for the 7,500 employees that we have here on the Capitol complex, as well as the tens of thousands of visitors who come to this area every year. So with that, and I know that we have other testifiers, I just want to add that the Department of Public Safety supports this bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. Hello. I don't have you on the list, so you want to introduce yourself for the committee?
Yes. My name is Bob Meyerson. I'm a major with the State Patrol, and I'm currently the Director of Security for the Capitol Complex. And as Assistant Commissioner mentioned, we function through some direct appropriations and some contracts. We have 10 contracts with the different departments throughout the complex, the building. So, for example, we have a contract with the Department of Transportation to staff one security officer there. We have a contract with the Judicial Center to staff one security officer in their building. The Department of Human Services, we have additional security officers there through contracts. It's cumbersome because we're bound by these contracts, and the deployment of our staffing and resources is based upon the priorities given by the different entities throughout the complex, rather than by making an objective assessment of where our staffing needs are. If we relied upon the resources that are given to us through our direct appropriations, we'd have only 9 security officers versus the 40 that we have. The rest are all staffed through the contracts.
So, Mr. Meyerson, these aren't state troopers. They're maybe off-duty police officers? Or
no, our staff is made up of a complement of two. We have two different groups. We have state troopers, and there are two of us that are assigned full-time to the Capitol Complex throughout the year. Mm-hmm. And then we have 40 civilian security officers. So those that you see about in the Capitol with the blue uniforms on, they're civilian security guards or security officers without peace officer authority. Mm-hmm. And they serve a vital and important function. They help us to deter and to detect, you know, criminal activity. And I think that they do bring about a sense of confidence that it's a secure environment. However, they do have limitations based upon, you know, what their
And Mr. Meyerson, they're contract employees or they're state employees working for the Department of Public Safety?
They are state employees working for the Department of Public Safety.
Okay.
They are funded, however, through the vast majority and through contracts with the different departments throughout. So they are our employees.
But then you charge back the agencies.
And where it's constricting is when we see that we have a need to shift our staffing personnel for whatever the event is or what the circumstances are, we're limited, and I have a contractual obligation to staff these buildings throughout the complex, so we don't have the ability to kind of on a daily basis morph them into where they need to be. So it
sounds very inefficient.
Extremely, yes.
Did I interrupt you, or did you have more to say?
I don't know. I think that covers it. I just wanted to address the issue with the contracts and how this bill does address that. Okay. And helps us to better equip us with our assigning and staffing.
Any questions for Mr. Meyerson? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe this is more to Senator Benson. In the bill, it says a part of the division permanent staff the director must establish. Who's the director?
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, the Director of Public Safety.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meyerson, do you have a rank? Major? Is it Major Meyerson? Could you tell me... rating our security now from 1 to 10, where are we at?
Major Meyerson.
Madam Chair, Senator Hall, that's a tough question. I think we rank above 1 and far below 10. I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to.
Jury's not a politician.
Yeah, right. It's really a relevant statement on I think we're up there with the given resources that we have. I think we rank up there near a 10, you know, utilizing our resources. However, we are lacking in areas, and we have vulnerabilities. We're assuming risks.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hall.
Thank you. You know, I've always felt really safe here, and that's why I asked the question. But I'm hearing so far all of you say we need it. And I respect and know many of you. So did you have something to say, Senator Benson?
And Senator Hall, through the process of getting to work with these gentlemen with our own sergeants-at-arms, they have regular meetings, and when they see an event coming forward, they pull in other resources. They've gotten very creative. You'll see red jackets and blue jackets brought in lower cost, specific purpose, just to help visitors feel welcome, know that they're safe, that there's somebody available. So they do very well with the resources that we've given them. But we're in a transitional time right now, and if we're ever going to make this change, this would be the time to do it.
Okay. Justice Anderson, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for having me here today. I have about 4 or 5 points I need to make, and I'll try to make them as succinctly as possible. First of all, I want to play off what Assistant Commissioner Donaski said. And I'll use a statement by my former colleague, the late Sandra Gardebring. And she says, have we admired this problem enough? We have admired this problem plenty. I mean, I am now in my last 3 months on the court, and it's a problem that I've been working on since I came on the court and seen very, very little progress.
And how many years ago was that?
I started on the Court of Appeals in 1992, and I realized maybe it's time that I'm leaving because I see how much younger all of you are than I am. But
some
any
of
case,
us were around then.
But anyway, is it no, it's the time to start now. And I'm very serious about this, is that you noticed a little hesitation by the major when you asked us where do we rank, because I think he wanted to ask, can we go into executive session? Because, quite frankly, if you have a full disclosure of the nature of the security in this complex, you don't want to talk about it too much. I'm reluctant to talk about it because I'm quite exposed. Now, the court has looked at this proposal. We generally support it. I want to tell you it's no panacea. It's a start. That's all it is. It's getting it to start. And what is good about it? One, I need to compliment the members of the committee that put this report together. They worked very hard. The lieutenant governor headed it up, and I was very impressed with the two senators and the two representatives, the thoughtfulness and the work they put into it.
Senator Benson, are copies of those report available?
There are copies of the report. I can have my staff get more copies to each of your offices. Otherwise, they are available online.
Okay,
and I can send that link.
Yeah, you could send us the link. I think that'd be fine.
Thank you.
So why it's a good start is that it starts to put responsibility in one place. Now, that means that we give up some control over our security, and I'm quite frankly willing to do that because the balkanization of security around this Capitol complex, I want to put somebody who has responsibility. I'm not the best one to make those decisions sometime, and so I'm completely comfortable having the Commissioner of Public Safety say, now you provide what you think is the right amount of safety, and you provide some coordinated safety. And I'm going to tell you how it's sometimes I'm not the best one to make that decision. Because when it's balkanized is that you give us a budget, and you say, here's $500,000. Why don't you put a security system in over at the Judicial Center? We have no security system really over there. And we had it all designed ready to go, and we get a budget crunch. And I'm one of the decision makers sitting there saying is that, we either can put it to services or we can put it to security. And you guess what we did? We put it to court services. We didn't want to cut back for the citizens. And see, that's why I may not be the best person to make those safety decisions. Now, that can lead to some very absurd circumstances. We had a shooting over in Hennepin County. The perpetrator's name was Berkowitz. The woman who was shot was the daughter of Jerry Joseph. Some of you recognize her, a rather illustrious name in the history of the state of Minnesota. And we are hearing the direct appeal of that first-degree murder conviction. The family comes there for the hearing, and we get communication. Are you guys absurd? Are you stupid? Here we are hearing a case about a shooting in a courtroom, seven justices sitting up there, and not a lick of security in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the way it is generally with us. And so what we have here is that we got the start for a solution, and I want to make a point of it. Now, I just made the point that I'm not a good decision maker on this. And I want to address you as to all of you is that, Senator, you say you're safe, okay? I'm safe, you know, but I have a different concept of safety for me. I'm a public elected official, and I'm here, and I assume a certain amount of responsibility, but I had an eye-opening experience last summer, and what the fallout of it, when I went to Libya and then to Tunisia, I met with Ambassador Stevens. By the way, Libya, there was genocide. By the way, Senator Stevens prevented a genocide of 75 to 100,000 people in Benghazi. That's why. One, he felt comfortable in Benghazi, and why some people want to get after. But, you know, Senator Stevens is everything they say about him. He was a marvelous public servant, but he's much like us. You know, he wanted to do his job, thought he'd be protected, and willing to assume the risk, and he died, okay? But three other people died with him. See, that's why you have to assume the responsibility here. It's not about you folks. Now, each of you running for election, you serve a certain amount of responsibility, but you are accountable for everybody who works in this Capitol complex. So the time is now that you start acting. And so is it don't seek refuge as well. I'm safe. I'm a public official. I assume a certain amount of risk because it's not about you. It's not about me. You saw what I did when I was given the choice of protecting the people who work in the Judicial Center or providing services. I went on the services side. But I do know that people are very, very exposed in our building. One final point is that as good as this proposal is, you need to understand what a precious resource this Capitol complex is. I mean, this building, Cass Gilbert designed it as the People's Building, and is that you need whatever you do is when you come up with a plan, ultimately, you understand you don't interfere with the core function of that building. It's a place where the people can come and see how government works. You may be wondering, I'm sitting back here listening and say, is it Justice Anderson, it's got to be boring, whatever. I'm celebrating the fact that I live in this country, and I'm part of the process that you are part. Do you know how precious what's going on here is? It really is. I mean, once you've sat on a symposium trying to design a constitution for Tunisia, you really respect what you have. But you have one of your core functions. The senator talked about safety is a core function that you have as leaders in this community. So you need to make sure that that core function is taken care of. But I'm going to give you a couple of articles, one by Bill Gates, another one by Farber, professor at the university. And this one focuses on consilience. And that's the idea of designing something structured so you get your job done. You know, he set up Pixar, a very successful company, but it said how he didn't allow technology or architecture to get in the way of providing what was the core function of making that company successful. Farber talks about the dead hand of the architect. Understand that anything you folks do in design with respect to security here and authorize, the major is very competent professional, you're a competent professional, but they don't see it the way you do. They see it more technically. They don't see what the consilience, what the purpose is. And so whatever you design, make it work so that the people can still come here and so that you folks can still do your job, because that's very, very, very key to how you do it. But I'm going to end by saying, please, please, don't admire it anymore. You've admired it enough. There is real danger. Take the risk. It's not about you. It's not about me. It's about these other people around us who will be the collateral damage if we don't do our job. And believe me, if we don't, we'll be held accountable. Any questions?
Thank you for those excellent comments. I was in Tunisia December 2011, the day they were electing their new president. I'm not sure when you were there.
I was there in June of
2012.
Yeah, may I make a comment since you bring that up?
Sure.
I'm sitting out on a symposium, and I have people, a professor next to me knows the Constitution of the United States more than most people do, and it was fascinating. I had two women, one who's sitting on the Constitutional Commission. It amazed me how careful those women were and everybody when they talked about the rights of women in the new Tunisia. Understand how privileged we are, and is that, you know, they start out with a constitution that says we are an Islamic country. We start out as we are a secular country, and it's what sinful in religion doesn't have to be illegal here. Mm-hmm. It does there. We've got a marvelous system. We really do. We really do. Protect it.
Well, Tunisia actually granted rights to women quite a while ago, after independence. And so I know the women in Tunisia are concerned about what being an Islamic nation will mean in terms of their
The new constitution
rights.
Is not very favorable
it's
to
It's not
women.
Very favorable to
no,
women.
No, it is not.
That's too bad.
Madam Chair, I have a question.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you. Senator, I am reading Subdivision 3 in Section 2, and I'm just a little curious about the language. It says in here that the Commissioner of Public Safety shall have the final authority regarding the public safety and security of the Capitol complex. And that says the Commissioner of Administration shall have the power and duty and responsibilities relating. So this entire subdivision kind of goes back and forth between the Commissioner of Public Safety and the Commissioner of Administration from the beginning, the powers and duties and responsibilities. So is it transferred to the Commissioner of Public Safety, or is it the Commissioner of Administration? I'm just confused.
Is this a question for Mr. Danaski or for Senator Benson or
whomever has the answer? I don't know if I am reading this incorrectly, but it the powers and duties transferred.
Yeah, there is some kind of shared responsibility here. It looks like Senator Benson.
Yes,
Madam President and Senator Torres-Ray, I believe the line starting at the end of 2.6 that talks about relating to the general function of security transfers to the Commissioner of Public Safety. So it doesn't, the Department of Administration would still be responsible for the general functioning of the buildings, but when it comes to security, then that defaults to the Department of Public Safety. And I'll give you an example of how security and administration have already been working together. As light rail went through, the tunnel had to be redone. And so to implement good security practices, they moved the loading dock across the street and built the tunnel to accommodate large carts to move items through. Now, if you think about it, having a truck back up to the back of the Capitol and being able to unload is a risk. And so by thinking about smart design and as we renovate the Capitol, doing more things like that, not reducing access, reducing vulnerability would be the goal of a balanced security system built in an architectural design.
Ms. James, would you tell us a little bit more about Chapter 16B?
Madam Chair and members, 16B covers a variety of aspects of managing the Capitol. For example, 16B.2405 provides for the commissioner to maintain and operate the Capitol building and grounds, designate a project manager to oversee and manage pre-design, design, and construction contracts, leasing space in the Capitol, things of that nature. Things having to do with, installing the solar energy panels, heating and cooling systems in the buildings, energy use in the buildings, a whole variety of things that are not safety related.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So there's kind of a division there.
Senator
Benson.
Madam Chair and Senator Torres-Ray, if those two are in conflict, there is an advisory committee that they can come to and we can help decide where resources might go. I would believe they would rather settle it amongst themselves than come before a bunch of politicians to try to solve a problem. But in any case, there is a mechanism so that if a particular function of government is feeling like they are not being well served in this model, there's a place where we can make those changes. And we're required to meet annually to review.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Can I make a comment?
Justice Anderson.
I mean, this is a seminal shift. This is putting responsibility with the Commissioner of Public Safety. And we don't like to give up power and authority and control, but I figure that this is the best result because I'm going to sit down or somebody follows me with the commissioner says, this is what we need. We need your expert advice. And by the way, if something goes wrong, believe me, you're going to be held accountable because I've asked you what I need for. So it's a seminal change, but it's trusting in that you'll get the design that you need under this system. I'm willing to take that risk.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions for any of the witnesses? Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, Ms. James, on page one of it says, where it says the director and Senator Benson said the director is the Commissioner of Public Safety, would it be wise for us to have, where it's mentioned director on several lines there, to have in there the Commissioner of Public Safety versus the director?
I apologize, Madam Chair. I misspoke. It is Major Meyerson who is the director. They are two different people, and I apologize. I was not answering your question clearly, and I'm sorry.
So, Madam Chair, the director is then Capitol Security, or who is the person?
Major Meyerson, what's
Major
your title?
Myers.
Madam Chair, Senator, the director of public safety, or excuse me, the director of Capitol Security, as referenced here, is my position. I'm currently holding that position as Director of Capitol Security.
Okay, Ms. James wants to help clarify.
Yes.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, in the previous section of the chapter, which is not in this previous subdivision, it describes that the director is the Director of Capitol Complex Security. So from the context of the chapter, it's clear that the director is the director of the Capitol Complex Security.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, then the emergency manager that the director here is being asked to, will then he be or she be underneath the director's responsibility, or where will that emergency manager position be located, here in the complex or within the public safety division?
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, I believe, and I'll defer to Major Meyerson on this, that that emergency manager would work for Major Meyerson and report up through the Division of Public Safety kind of chain of command to be held accountable.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Senator Benson, on the second page on the bottom for appropriation, I know we're not supposed to be monkeying with it, but it talks about from the general fund to the Commissioner of Public Safety for the Capitol Complex Security Division, and then it says appropriation money must also include the emergency manager position. Why wouldn't we just give them the money to the director and let or the commissioner? Well, it is says commissioner, but why? I don't know why we have to delineate that, but I'm just it's curious.
Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, I think it's to be clear that there must be funds allowed for an FTE position of emergency manager, and that it also mentions an increase in the number of state troopers, complement to 12. And so there are specific items that were fleshed out as we worked through the summer and this fall that we wanted to be specific in requesting in the appropriation, and those dollars are being figured out right now.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Benson, on Section 2, Subdivision 3, that section we were just talking about, will that affect any of the work around the capital restoration? Is that going to have any kind of impact there?
I'm not sure what you mean by effect, but one of the things that we request is that through the restoration process, there's a best practices standard for security and that the architects review that and comply with it. We had specialists from the University of Minnesota and from Target Corporation come in and help us develop this. This wasn't born out of whole cloth by the legislature. It's what they use and what they would recommend for us. If that
answers. Justice Anderson.
Madam Chair and Senators, if I take a shot at that, because I also serve on the Preservation Committee, and we made an effort that we would coordinate our efforts with the Preservation Committee, because you have a joining together of a recognition and need for better security on the Capitol complex at the same time as this building is looked at for restoration. And the idea is that there will be communication and they'll work hand in hand. So there's any restoration takes into consideration what are the demands and the needs of the modern world with respect to security.
And I think the tunnel was a good example of that. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Major Meyerson, how do we, as far as security, compare with other state capital complexes throughout the U.S.?
Major Meyerson.
Madam Chair, Senator, in regards to staffing, we rank fourth lowest of capital complexes as far as licensed police officers assigned to the Capitol. The 2009 legislative auditor's report reflected that, and I think it came as a surprise. We knew that we were towards the bottom end, but didn't realize we were as low as that. In regards to, and it's hard, you're kind of comparing apples to oranges, I believe, because we have 140 acres, and I did a much smaller survey of other capitals regarding some issues, and I realized some of the capitals have much smaller compact and their post standards for police officers are a little different than ours, but just at first blush, you look at it, and we have two police officers assigned on a year-round basis compared to some that have over 100 to their complexes and complexes that are smaller than ours. So in that regards, we fall far short.
And I know when I visited other capitals, a lot of them do have metal detector systems, too, for entrance.
And Madam Chair, you brought that up. That is not something that our advisory committee recommended. We decided that, as that was controversial and needed to be based on design and security needs, that making a specific recommendation was not appropriate at this time. And so we did discuss it in depth and decided to defer to specific needs based on building design by security professionals.
Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Senator Benson, or yes, your testifiers, this has been investigated or been an ongoing thing, and as Judge Anderson has already said, that it's long overdue. How long ago did this actually come to the forefront for increasing the security for the Capitol?
Who has
other
the
than
history?
Just recently?
Madam Chair, I don't have the full history. I'm guessing if you wanted to pull Sven Lindquist aside sometime, he could give you his very blunt opinion. But after 9/11, there was those moments of, we have to protect every public building. And so there's a quickening. And then when the RNC came, there was another quickening. And then when Gabby Giffords was shot, there was another quickening. And finally, we're getting to the point where we think we have a structure that is workable. Ideally, security changes and morphs with a population and growth of the complex and needs of the people who work here and visit here. But we've been putting this off and putting this off and getting by and doing well with what we have. And now it's time to accept some responsibility and put a person in charge of it, give them the resources that we believe are prudently needed, and work on creating a secure Capitol area.
Any other questions? Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to say, well, first off, all the testimony is really good. I was hoping we were going to hear from Sergeant-at-Arms Sven Lindquist, but I see he had to leave. I wasn't quite sure. I thought I'd have to address Justice Anderson as Your Honor, but I guess Justice Anderson's the right way. And I think he had a really good point. It's not about us. It is about, and though some didn't mention the kids, the amount of kids that come in here and the protection of them I think is important, and certainly our staff is important. We all know that. And I don't know how many people are actually in the complex, but to think of the responsibility we have, I think it's pretty neat. The other aspect that I do like hearing is that we've had a lot of people from other countries visit here, and one of the things they're really amazed is that they have they see no security at the doors. They're not going through something, and they can't even imagine. Sometimes they can even get in to talk to us, and that's how great our country is. So I appreciate that you've looked at that, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that, but thank you.
And, Madam Chair, if I may, to Senator Hall's point, we spent a lot of time talking about the need for this Capitol area to be open to the public in appearance and in reality. You can accomplish security by restricting access and putting everybody through, you know, security pat-downs, but that just inhibits the process of government. Our reason for being here is to have an open, transparent government of the people. And so whatever security we do, it's in the mission statement, and it's in the report. And it is my hope that now by stating this on the record again, we will make sure that as we go forward, remain open to the public.
Is there anyone else in the audience who'd like to testify on this bill? Okay, yeah.
I just want to say, wow. I mean, you know, I just love what we do in this country and what you folks do here. It's just such a privilege to work in a system because I've seen it in so many other situations where it doesn't work. So thank you for all you do. I'm very much appreciated.
And thank you for being here today.
And thank you, Madam Chair.
I don't know what it means about separation of powers, but...
Well, I was expecting some questions. I mean, is that you want about the Constitution and amendments? I'm ready.
Thank you. And, Madam Chair, if you could have someone move the bill for me. Thank you.
Anybody? Okay. Senator Hall. Done. Senator Hall, Senator Scalzi, we'll jointly move that Senate File 344 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Senator.
And everyone. Senate File 443, Senator Goodwin. And Senator Goodwin has a author's amendment.
I do, Madam Chair. It's 443A-2. We have that in our packet. And what this does is delete Section 1, and then on page 2, line 19, after the second services, insert a comma.
All those in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Senator Goodwin.
Madam Chair and members, Senate File 443 is a bill that basically gives employees protection, state employees protection, when they discuss with their legislator or other legislators potential problems in state agencies that they have been they feel unsafe or they feel their job is at risk if they talk to their supervisor or commissioner. This isn't a new bill, and this isn't as a result of Governor Dayton's administration. This bill went through the legislature on bipartisan vote in about 96 or 97 and was vetoed by the then governor. It is a whistleblower protection. It's at just an additional it's an addition to the current whistleblower laws, and what we'd really like to see is that if a state employee, and I have had this happen several times, and maybe some of you have too, comes to you with information that that either is reporting a problem, maybe a misuse of dollars, maybe that they want to discuss an issue with a legislative auditor so that they possibly will recommend doing an evaluation or program or fiscal evaluation on it, then they should be able to do that without worrying about being fired, quite simply. It's difficult for state employees who are there on a regular basis, and they change commissioners and governors, and those people change quite often. And they're not always sure about what the response will be if they do report these internally. And since we are responsible for the budgets of the state, I think it's very important that we have the ability to discuss these issues with state employees and even with our constituents without them having to fear that they will be fired as a result of that. So I would like Kendall Killian to explain a little bit more about the employee's point of view here.
Mr. Killian.
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Kendall Killian. I'm the Public Affairs Coordinator for MAPE, Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. I represent over 13,000 state professional employees. MAPE supports Senate File 443 because it would provide state employees with enhanced whistleblower protections so they are protected when communicating with you. This bill would strengthen whistleblower protections for state employees if they communicate with legislators. This bill allows employees in classified service to disclose information that an employee in good faith believes to be truthful and accurate, relates to state service or their finances to a legislator without retaliation or discipline. Each year, the MAPE Delegate Assembly, which is kind of our annual convention, determines our core legislative positions and priorities. The current MAPE legislative priorities document, which was passed last fall by our organization, states directly that we support whistleblower protections exactly like those covered in this bill. MAPE members are committed to making our state government operate more efficiently and effectively. In fact, in 2010, MAPE members put forth over $1 million in cost savings ideas to help save the state budget deficit. Our members want to make sure the state works more efficiently, but to do that, they need protections in statute so they are protected when communicating with legislators. Our organization is committed to being part of the budget solution, both in this biennium and in the future, and this bill will aid our efforts to put forth cost-saving solutions. That's why we ask you to support this bill. Thank you.
One more thing, Madam Chair and members. At times, even over the past 20 years or so, and however long I've been involved in these issues, not only are state employees afraid to come forward with information sometimes, but they're also told that they can't. And different administrations, different commissioners, different supervisors have told them, you know, don't go to legislator, don't go to a legislator. Not everything goes through here, through us. So that is, you know, I think that there are times when we need that information. I know I've gotten very valuable information that ultimately ended some practices of patronage and nepotism in the state contracting system, and I got that information only because some state employees were not were afraid but came forward anyway and gave me the names and the ways that contracting was being done illegally. So I would have not found that out from the agency, of course, so it's been helpful.
Any questions for Mr. Killian or the author? Does anyone else want to testify? We had Ms. O'Brien, Commissioner O'Brien, on the list. There she is. Hi. So, Brian, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Ann O'Brien, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Human Resource Management at Minnesota Management and Budget. And I'm here today to just discuss our concerns with this bill. We appreciate the removing of Section 1, but I still wanted to express some concern that we believe that there is already effective whistleblower language in Minnesota Statutes 181 that do address the concerns about state employees having that protection and going forward. We believe that the bill could limit the executive branch's authority to manage information, its personnel, and could impair its ability to do its job. The language could mean that executive branch employees may prematurely bring their concerns about budgetary or bargaining matters to the legislature, which as a practical matter, when we develop those positions and we look at all of the factual information in our financial planning and our negotiations planning, that process goes through many iterations, and versions are often rejected for good reason. To spend the time discussing all of these matters could impact our ability to move forward on situations and make decisions that we believe are in the best interests of the state. We take our responsibility to hold employees accountable very seriously, and we have incidents where employees are terminated for just cause for inappropriate conduct. We will be talking to you later this week about misconduct when it comes to data practices violations and breaches. And in that is an example of a situation where an employee who was found guilty of a data breach, as found in a thorough investigation, could have gone to a legislator and provided information on any topic and then claimed whistleblower protection before they were dismissed. That disclosure could realistically create a scenario in which she could claim that was unfair, which would send us through a process of grievance process or a lawsuit, which would take additional time to resolve the issue. There was also a situation in a state agency which was when they investigated the outcomes of an accident or incident, and one of the employees on the team disagreed with the final decision of the investigation group on the details of the incident. When the agency was asked to testify before Congress on their findings, the employee who disagreed also testified to his contrary opinion, which resulted in a lawsuit against the state by both involved insurance companies because the state had two contrary opinions on the issue. And I just bring that up to say there are times where a decision has to be made. We're fully aware of the way that the employees feel or disagree, but ultimately the decision made on behalf of the state could have had a negative impact. As decisions are made, we encourage our employees to bring their concerns and input to the attention of decision makers, and we prefer to consider their input prior to the decision being made rather than second-guessing a situation. It is not unexpected that with major decisions, people will have differing views, and we know that reasonable people will disagree on one way to take something or another. Also, we have the concerns that the employee could be put into a difficult situation to keep legislative inquiry confidential if it resulted in them providing an opinion about a topic where they're not as knowledgeable as others about the topic, or if they have concerns about providing information at all. Again, we're not clear on the problem we're solving. We think that there are other ways that we could solve this problem. We prefer to focus on improving the flow of information between the legislative branch and the executive branch and address your concerns rather than creating broad legislation that could cause issues in other areas. Again, we believe there are sufficient protections and remedies under Section 181 for employees who provide information to government bodies. Thank you.
And Senator Goodwin.
Madam Chair, I think there are protections in 181, but they don't refer specifically to these issues with state employees. I stand with my statement that we need to make sure that employees are free to report problems in the agency if that they see. I can give several examples of people from, not who the people are, but people from different agencies that have alerted me to actually millions of dollars worth of problems with contractors whose work went unfinished, and they had to finish it within the agency, but the agency wouldn't let them go because there was a revolving door issue going on. There's just been a lot of them over the years, and I'm not saying it's with this particular governor's administration, but in my opinion, our state employees are also taxpayers, and they are concerned, and sometimes they have firsthand information that we can't get anywhere else. And I think, you know, we can fear that they're going to give us information that's that should be protected for some reason by the agency. But I do think that that's an issue that can be straightened out between the legislator and the department. I don't see legislators being irresponsible and going out and talking to the press or whatever. I don't see that happening. I think that several of us, many of us, have had different employees come to us. All we're saying is let's protect them.
And this bill will, does have to go to Judiciary Committee to look at the data privacy issues that the commissioner brought up. Senator Hall.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Goodwin, you made the point that there are employees that have a hard time thinking they can't come to us, and then your response was, I've had employees come to me. So it sounds like they've come to you. It sounds like it's legal. And maybe they just need to know more that that's their option, and or why do we need to put it in specific if they already have that law and they're still available to do it right now?
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Goodwin,
Senator Hall, they have come. Some have come, and when they do, oftentimes they want to meet someplace out of the way so it's not in the Capitol. We have had administrations that have said, do not talk to legislators about this. Even if they call and ask you a specific question, do not talk to legislators. So that's my concern, is that they don't always feel free to do that. And the ones that have been very afraid of losing their positions. So.
And they usually ask to be anonymous,
yes.
You know, to protect their identity. Yeah, I've had people contact me too, but very much on the QT.
Right.
They're right. Very quietly and can't use their name at all if you bring it up with the commissioner of the department. And right.
Correct.
Any other questions from anyone? As I mentioned, this will go to Judiciary Committee. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Goodwin, can you give an example of a situation here based on the language on 2.17 through 2.21 where an employee may want to come to a constitutional officer or a legislator to...
Senator Goodwin, I think maybe you need to be a little more specific. You talked about contracts and nepotism and...
Yes, Madam Chair, and Senator
Anderson.
I can give you lots of examples. I've had people come. If you want me to name the agencies, I can even do that. But come about some particular issues with. Actually, I've had more than one with the Department of Transportation, with the Department of Human Services. Those are the two biggest ones that I've had employees come forth and talk to me about. About issues that in my opinion, that I built legislation around, sometimes successfully passed pieces of it, sometimes didn't. But that that was given to me, and I checked out, and turned out to be very reliable information, that there wouldn't have been a way that I could have gotten that information from a supervisor or a commissioner. And it definitely had an impact on what changed in state law. And I don't know how much more specific I can do without naming particular circumstances. I sure wouldn't name the people, but without naming specifics about the case, so that should those employees still be there, you know, they would be maybe recognized in some way. recently, not real recently, but about 6 months ago or so, I had an employee come to me talking about the misuse of funds that are supposed to go into one program and are not being used for that. They're being diverted for something else. So that's a few examples.
Okay. Anybody else?
Does anyone want to make a motion? I'll move. All right, Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 443, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay.
Nay.
Motion prevails. Okay, Senator Goodwin. Thank Senator you. Dahl, Senate File 406.
Yes, sorry about that. What's in your mind, man?
And Senator Dahl has a delete all amendment.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We do have the A3 amendment.
Senator Dahl moves Senate the A3 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Dahl.
And thank you, Madam Chair and committee. Thanks for sticking around. We will be brief, and my testifiers are going to be very brief as well. The Minnesota Youth Council, and I'll tell you a little bit more, is an initiative of the Minnesota Alliance with Youth. A diverse network of 72 8th through 12th graders and adult partners from each congressional district who collaboratively identify and address youth issues. Members share their perspectives with policymakers, honing critical thinking, public speaking, leadership skills, and addressing the dilemma that although young people can't vote, they often face the consequences of our policy decisions here. So what Senate File 406 does, it recognizes the Minnesota Youth Council Committee. It's organized under the Minnesota Alliance with Youth as a non-profit private organization, as a liaison for youth from around the state to the legislature and the governor. In addition, this bill would require the legislature to appoint four legislators to serve as legislative liaisons to the Minnesota Youth Council Committee, with service alternating between the House and Senate, and with representation from both majority and minority parties. So I will turn it over to first Corey Redpenning, and she will give her a brief testimony.
Thank you. Would you please state your name and title? Sure. Thank
yep.
you.
Corey Redpenning, and Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify about this legislation. As I said, my name is Corey Redpenning, and I serve as the Director of Engagement and Policy with the Minnesota Alliance with Youth, and I have the privilege of working with the Minnesota Youth Council. This bill reflects our strong commitment to the importance of providing young people opportunities to bring their voice to the legislative process and to support and inform policy decisions, particularly those impacting young people directly. The proposed bill will formalize the relationship between the Minnesota Youth Council and all of you to ensure that youth voice is integrated into the legislature. The Minnesota Alliance with Youth, which is the organization that supports the Minnesota Youth Council, was founded in 1997. Along with our national affiliate, the America's Promise Alliance, which was formed as a result of the President's Summit for America's Future, which was chaired by General Colin Powell. The goal of the summit was to mobilize every sector of American life to build the character and competence of our nation's youth by fulfilling five fundamental promises to all young people, which include caring adults, safe places, a healthy start, an effective education, and opportunities to give back to communities. Utilizing this proven framework, the Minnesota Alliance with Youth works to provide these five promises with and for youth statewide. The Minnesota Youth Council is one of our key programs and ensures that youth have a voice in determining how we provide these resources to youth throughout Minnesota. Our organization fundamentally believes in the power of youth serving alongside adults, as found in our name, the Minnesota Alliance with Youth. We know that far too often we see young people as only the recipients of services or as having problems to fix, rather than seeing young people as part of the solution, as powerful assets and resources. In an effort to change this, the Minnesota Youth Council utilizes a youth adult partnership model, and you will have the opportunity to hear from one of our adult partners and two of our youth council members momentarily. The Minnesota Alliance with Youth is uniquely positioned to sponsor the statewide council and support its relationship with the legislature. We have a strong and diverse network of over 500 partners that represent individuals, organizations, associations, schools, and communities. More specifically, this project has strong support from youth-serving organizations statewide. We have developed a strategic partnership with Youth Prize, a new out-of-school time intermediary, and Youth Thrive, a statewide nonprofit, to integrate additional funding and training resources into the Minnesota Youth Council. Additionally, we have recently developed a partnership with the Minnesota Department of Education that will allow a unique opportunity for the Minnesota Youth Council members to have a voice in a crucial part of their lives, education and the education system itself. We have recruited a committed and diverse council made up of youth and adults from each congressional district that care deeply about this work and that represent rural, urban, and suburban communities all throughout Minnesota. We also support highly qualified staff to provide extensive training and support for the youth and adult members. We are proud to have bipartisan support for this work at a local, state, and federal level. We also have the necessary funding and infrastructure in place to run the council, and we are not seeking state-level funding to support this work. We believe that just as the Minnesota Alliance with Youth cannot do its work without young people, neither can the state of Minnesota. In a recent statewide survey conducted by Minnesota Youth Council members, we learned that only 47% of youth feel they have the power to make change in their community, and 33% say that they have little or no knowledge of how to make that happen. Through the Minnesota Youth Council and with your support, we fully intend to change that. Thank you for your support and the opportunity to speak with you today.
Kelly Timian.
Ms. Timian.
Welcome Madam to Chair. The committee. And committee members, I would like to thank you for this wonderful opportunity. My name is Kelly Timian, and I'm a Title I paraprofessional at Augsburg Fairview Academy Charter High School in Minneapolis, and I also serve as an adult sponsor on the Minnesota Youth Council. Young people in Minnesota are incredibly bright and creative thinkers that have much to offer the world. After 2 years with the council, I am profoundly inspired by its shared ideas, action, and passion. Youth engaging in dialogue about issues affecting youth has played a valuable role in bringing awareness and perspective to our communities. Equally important are the subsequent actions taken to address those identified issues that compel youth to undertake the initiative and responsibility necessary to effect change on local and statewide levels. The exchange of knowledge is extremely powerful, and I have witnessed several meaningful exchanges among youth and adults driven by the council's goals. These exchanges manifest the value of authentic relationships that give youth a voice in decisions that will impact their lives. I have watched not only my student council members, but other youth with a desire to engage in and understand the legislative process grow from inactive to active contributors to the communities in which they live and attend school. It is my personal belief that these youth will continue to work towards building solutions and strengthening communities throughout their lives. The passing of this legislation would demonstrate our commitment to ensuring that youth are valued and equal partners in Minnesota's future. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, we'll hear from Nick Plaza.
Mr. Plaza.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Nicholas Plaza, and I'm a member of the Minnesota Youth Council representing Fergus Falls, Minnesota in Congressional District 7. I'm here to express my support for the passing of the Minnesota Youth Council bill. In 2010, the U.S. Census Bureau reports that the number of people under the age of 18 was 1,284,063 compared to 4,019,862 adults in the state of Minnesota. That's one-fourth of the state's population, which is a very large group to be underrepresented. The Minnesota Youth Council bill would turn us into an official advisory council. Since joining the council 2 years ago, I have learned about the legislative process. I have learned how to be a voice for young people all around the state, not just in my own community. I have learned that life isn't always fair. However, I believe that everyone should have a voice. It is easy for youth to be brushed aside, ideas forgotten, or ignored. No one wants to see that. The passing of the Minnesota Youth Council bill would solidify a place for youth in the legislative process and give young people an opportunity for representation in our political system. When I moved here from Arizona, I was like a fish out of water. I didn't know anyone. I wasn't in any sports. I wasn't making change. I was just busy being changed. That stopped when I joined the Youth Council. This is where I began to feel like I mattered. That's the easy part. Now I take pride in representing others and also being a role model. The 26th Amendment to the United States Constitution states, "The right of citizens of the United States who are 18 years or older to vote shall not be denied or abridged." Does this mean that if you are under 18, you cannot express your opinions? No. We have a right to be heard. If not through the vote, then another way. We deserve to express our ideas with legislators who care about our opinions, as every citizen of the United States does. With your help and support, we can make this happen, and we can work as youth and state legislators together. We can make a difference, if only for one person like me. One final thing, a quote from Confucius. A youth is to be regarded with respect. How do we know that his future will not be equal to our present? Thank you.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, one more testifier, Denicia Parker.
Ms. Parker, welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Denicia Parker. I am from Minneapolis, and I represent Congressional District 5 on the Minnesota Youth Council. As a youth member of the Minnesota Youth Council, I can speak to its impact on the young people involved in it. When I was in elementary school, the teachers were telling my mother that I should be in special ed and that I had a very bad case of ADHD. And it even got to the point where one of those teachers told me personally that I wouldn't make it past junior high. This weighed on me heavily, even after graduating from junior high. I think it's mostly because I wasn't doing anything with my time other than focusing on school. But when I joined the Minnesota Youth Council, it gave me the boost of confidence and let me know that I can do a lot more with my life than just getting good grades and volunteering. And now, instead of being in special ed, I'm in a growing number of Minnesota youth that are making an impact within the Minnesota communities. When I first joined the Minnesota Youth Council, I didn't expect for it to mean as much to me as it does now. After I actually started engaging in it, I realized it opened up more opportunities in 1 year than I've had in my entire lifetime. I feel like for the first time in my life, I'm doing something that is completely productive for me and affects others at the same time. Now I feel it is my responsibility to get back to where I was raised, as well as other communities that I've never even been to. The Minnesota Youth Council gave me the opportunity to learn more about Minnesota and connect me with other youth that have a strong desire to make change. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you very much for all your comments. Senator Dahl, any questions from members of the committee? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dahl, what is it about the Minnesota Youth Council that's summarized on this bill here that cannot be done with the Minnesota Alliance with Youth?
Senator Dahl.
You want to answer that? Sure. I mean, we're
Go ahead and introduce yourself.
Oh, yep, sorry. Madam Chair and Senator Anderson, we're really looking to formalize the relationship.
Could you repeat your name, please?
Oh, sorry.
I was
Corey
out of the
Redepenning.
Room. Okay. Ms. Redepenning.
Yes, thank you. We're looking to formalize the relationship between the Minnesota Youth Council and legislators. So really what we're looking for in the bill is, as you'll see the points about the liaisons, is to have those appointed people that the Minnesota Youth Council can work with. So while we are doing a lot of the work on our own, and as you can tell, they're gaining a lot from it, is to really formalize that relationship so that it's a sustainable partnership between the council and the Minnesota State Legislature.
And, Madam Chair, I believe that Ms. Redepenning could say that this has been around a while, an idea that you've had for several years, and maybe just want to comment on where this idea has been in the past.
Ms. Redepenning.
Sure, Madam Chair. So the council's been around since 2005, and in the last year have decided to grow the council, realizing it was a greater opportunity for young people, and have committed to recruiting youth council members from each of the 8 congressional districts, and have been working really closely with Representative Marquardt on how we can then really integrate youth voice into this building. We know that the youth council members enjoy being here and are interested in what's happening here, and so how can we do that work? So the Youth Council has been around for a long time, and so this is just sort of the next step in the process for really formalizing the relationship between the council and the legislature.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Ms. Redepenning, you've already been working with the legislature under the umbrella of Minnesota Alliance with Youth, Yeah, I mean, you've been coming to the Capitol and working with legislators from the start of your organization, I take it. Is that correct?
Ms. Redepenning.
Yes, we have been working with state legislatures, and really in the last year have really made the sort of shift in the focus that the council is working on, wants to work on policy efforts, and so that's part of where the bill first came to be a couple years ago. That's sort of where the vision came from, as we saw the growing interest from the council members to learn more about this process.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Years ago, I ran a youth activity council, and with the YMCA. I think it was the largest council in the country at the time. And I really appreciate all of you coming. I think it's really a neat idea. I think it's a needed group. I like what you're doing right now. I do question whether you have to make this a formalized group. I don't see the reason for that. We listen to you now. You're active, involved now. So I don't really see a big difference there. But again, I think the hearing the voice, and there's a lot of voices that represent the youth besides the Alliance. There are other ones out there. So I'm going to vote no on this. But I just want you to know, I think what you're doing is great. It's just I don't think we need to form something.
How is this different from youth and government, which is here all the time? Ms. Redepenning. Any of the youth.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if any of you guys want to take that one.
I'll add a little bit to that.
This is Mr. Plaza.
Madam Chair, Senators, one thing that I really enjoy about the Minnesota Youth Council is we're not just doing things as a council. I'm doing things in my own community on my own that I wouldn't have even considered thinking about without the help of the council and without the help of my adult sponsor through the council. So it's really a place where I can go get ideas and then bring them back to my own community instead of just staying here and like, yay, we support this bill, but, you know, doing some action in my own community.
And more about, a little bit more about youth and government and differences. Anybody want to tackle that?
Madam Chair, having been an advisor to youth and government before, you know, that's kind of like your mock trial of the legislature. It's really a kind of a, you don't really get to meet any legislatures unless they happen to be around the building. So it's a big program. It's a growing program, but it, you know, it's the process, learning about the process is real valuable. I think what you see here is, again, as Ms. Redepenning said, is that's kind of that next step. You can wander around the building, you can meet your legislatures, you can sit in on committees, but to actually have appointed members actually to listen to what their policy agendas are, to have a kind of a real voice at the table, that seems like that next step beyond you know, that 15-minute visit in your office. And, you know, I think it really kind of gives them a collective voice to a collective body that ultimately I think that we could hear from.
And you have Representative Marquardt, who's interested, and obviously Senator Dahl and Senator Hall. And I guess I, too, question why this kind of complicated process that we have in the bill, even in the delete all. Why is that necessary? Ms. Redepenning.
So the Youth Council, we have spent the last however many, probably 8 years, doing best practices research around youth councils, because for the same reasons you guys bring up, why do we need to formalize it? What difference does it make? And so what we've really learned is that in times where there hasn't been a strong commitment on both sides between the council and the legislature, that it hasn't been as sustainable. And so we know we want to do this work. We've been doing this work for 8 years, but we also want to know that the state legislature is committed to it as well. And so when I'm not working at the Alliance anymore, and maybe when some of you in this room aren't here, that we know it lives and breathes beyond us. And so we're really committed to that. And so we've really been looking at what's the best way of sort of taking the next step with the council. And I've done a tremendous amount of research to figure out what would that look like. And I did just want to answer the question in terms of youth and government, because we've actually met with the youth and government folks and have been talking about how do we sort of share resources, and they've really expressed interest of taking some of their young people who have really flourished in the mock trial or the mock sort of experience and really be able to put that into action, to have an opportunity like here today to testify at a Senate committee, that for some of their young people, that's the best next step if they're really engaged in the system. And so we're working to see how we can recruit some youth and government young people to serve on our council.
I guess I would feel more comfortable if we looked at existing models that we have already in law. So we have the minority councils, like the Council of Black Minnesotans, and they're more of a full-fledged agency. Their job is their advisory to the legislature. We have the Disability Council. We have the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, and they are funded and are staffed, at least minimally staffed. Okay, then we talked about youth and government, which is totally a nonprofit, or your organization, which is totally a nonprofit, like almost like a lobbying entity that would come to the legislature with their agenda. And that's, you know, and enlist legislators as their allies. And then we have commissions. We used to have more commissions. We had the Commission on the Economic Status of Women, and that was made up of legislators. And now we have the Office on the Economic Status of Women, which exists within the Legislative Coordinating Commission. And that could possibly be a home for this agency if you could establish, the Office of Minnesota Youth or something within the LCC, which would provide some minimal staffing and, you know, organize meetings. And you could have then your youth committee with legislators on it, or a legislative advisory committee and a youth advisory committee. I'm not quite sure. It would probably need some discussion about going in that direction. But that has been a, it's where the Region Advisory Council is placed. They provide some staffing, I think, to some of the other commissions. We have, like, the LCCMR. What else exists at the LCC? I just got appointed to it, so I'm just learning about it now. But that, I guess I'm not sure if this bill's ready for prime time, is what I'm saying, Senator Dahl. Does anybody else have any comments about it, concerns or questions? A couple people have expressed them. It will have to go to the Rules Committee, which is another reason why I would like it to be in a little better shape before it goes to the Rules Committee. Yes, Senator Johnson.
Most of you here have more knowledge about this type of thing than I have now. What I was looking at was the last subdivision where they would be given one Senate employee and one House employee to serve as staff for them. And I go back to the point that Nick, I think, said that told about the number of 18-year-olds that are in this state, and that I envision this being kind of like a policy advocate for young people. And I remember some time when I was in the House where I think it was Representative Kahn who brought the bill to say that young people should be allowed to vote at age 16.
I was the Senate author.
You did it too? Mm-hmm. Okay. And it didn't go over well at all around here. The other one I remember is when there was to be a bill passed that said, if you didn't do well in school, you couldn't have a driver's license.
Right.
That was it. Mm-hmm. That was another one. And I remember the comment was made, and I'd like to say I think it was me, but I'm not sure. I said, you know, it'd be interesting to see what happened. The vote was going down. And I said it would be interesting to see what would happen if the 16-year-olds were voters, because the law would change, because then you would be our constituents if you could have voted at 16. And that would have impacted on how we would have liked to have gone out into our districts and campaigned for reelection. And so I think, you know, more and more we're looking at the young people coming in and making comments and making recommendations on legislation, appropriate things. Probably not the, you know, some of the high finance and complicated bills that take place around here, but some of the more smaller bills that not least important, but very important, but not as complex, that a group like yourselves could make good recommendations to legislators. That's what I see here, that I haven't really seen any kind of a plan for that to happen.
Well, and I think that often mayors have youth advisory committees. The governor could establish a youth advisory committee. The other thing that's kind of problematic here is that it's the legislature recognizing one group, your Minnesota Youth Council Committee, as the official representative of all youth. And that, that, you know, the merging here between government and the nonprofit sector is a little unusual, I'd say. I don't want to be too derogative, but it's a little unusual for us to do. I just haven't seen something like this before, which is why I'm trying to think of some other kind of structure that is something that's more typical here. Yeah. Ms. Redepenning.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for that. And we did actually look at the, we have looked at the model of a governor's youth council. And that was one of the many ones we have studied, because that is a model probably most of you have heard of. And we have found that those have typically not been as sustainable from each administration to the next. So it tends to be a little bit more tied to that particular governor. And then when that governor leaves office, we haven't seen a lot of success in it being able to be carried on. And so just that was one of the things that we had looked at as well. So I appreciate that suggestion.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Hall.
I'd also like to say, you know, looking at line 1.5, or the Minnesota Alliance with Youth are those that organize this. I don't know enough about them necessarily, but I think there's a lot of youth programs and youth organizations out there. You know, before we jump and allow one to do it over another, I think we ought to maybe study these a little bit.
Well, I think any other advice? Okay, well then I guess I would just suggest that Senator Dahl and has some discussions with members of the committee, and that maybe we can come up with a structure that's a little more, I don't know, objective or a little more traditional, that works with kind of state government. I hate to disappoint you all, because I don't want you to think that we're going to kill your bill. We have time. It's early in session. And I think it's great that you want a stronger relationship with legislators. I'm just not sure if this is it yet. So with that, I'm going to lay over Senate File 406. And Senator Dahl, we'll be happy to work with you more on this. And any other discussion from the committee? Then do we have any, what do we have planned for Wednesday? Do we know yet?
No.
We don't know yet. Okay. The committee's adjourned.